This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This weekend, a statue of Jackie Robinson outside Dodger Stadium will be dedicated. That will be Robinson statue number 8. The most recent depicts Robinson sliding. Maybe he's stealing home. He did that from time to time. Dr. Chris Stride, who studies sports statuary, among other things, at the University of Sheffield Management School, believes there are more statues of Robinson than of any other U.S. athlete. But they didn't all come easily. Dr. Stride spoke to me this week from an island in Scotland where he was vacationing, and he told me that agitation for a statue of Robinson first began in 1972 in Pasadena, where Robinson had grown up. Mac Robinson, Jackie's brother, was the agitator.
It took him quite a long time, both to raise the money, but also to find somewhere to put it. Jackie Robinson didn't speak particularly kindly of his time in Pasadena as a child. The city authorities didn't particularly want it there. There wasn't a great clamor for it.
So they didn't get it. Mac Robinson's efforts finally bore statue in 1985 at UCLA, where Jackie had gone to college. 14 years later, another Robinson statue was unveiled in Stamford, Connecticut, where Robinson and his family moved in 1955. According to Dr. Stride, that one, like several of the others, represented a town's attempt to claim a connection to Robinson that may have required a little creative writing, as in creative rewriting of history.
There was rumors that the Robinsons weren't shown around possible houses because people did not want a black family moving in there. Mm-hmm. 40 years on, Stamford was quite keen to celebrate its association with Robinson. I felt that looking at Robinson's 7 statues, a lot of the impact that the people who built them were trying to make was to say that we were a community that helped Jackie Robinson. Not in a bad way, I'm not disparaging that, but it reinforced the idea that statues are as much about the people who erect them as the people they depict.
That's perhaps true of the monument that finally did appear in the place where Mac Robinson had first tried to honor his brother.
Ironically, the city of Pasadena did actually unveil a monument to Jackie Robinson. It's 2 giant heads. It's not really a statue. It's 2 giant busts of him and Mac. Hmm. The one of Jackie shows him looking away from Pasadena, the artist sort of reflecting the fact that he was quite keen to leave.
This month, it's 70 years since Jackie Robinson stepped onto the field in a Brooklyn Dodgers uniform, thereby becoming the first African-American major leaguer in baseball's so-called modern era. Our show this week celebrates his achievement and his legacy. The entryway to Ray Flynn's house in South Boston is lined with photographs of presidents and popes. As the former mayor of Boston and former ambassador to the Vatican, Flynn has met a couple of both. There's also a photo of Flynn with Mother Teresa, whom he calls my good friend, and another with Nelson Mandela. Flynn visited him in a South African prison 3 times. But the photograph that's missing, the one he'd really like to have, was never taken. And that's because during the late 1940s, when Flynn first met Jackie Robinson, he couldn't afford a camera or the cost of developing film. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Ray Flynn was a 10-year-old sports fan the first time he met Jackie Robinson.
All I ever wanted, I can say it now, I'm not running for political office, but all I ever wanted to be was play for the Celtics or for the Red Sox, not be mayor.
Flynn says he probably should have played shortstop because he had a good throwing arm, but he played second base because that was the position Jackie Robinson played. Flynn grew up Irish Catholic in South Boston. Jackie Robinson was, of course, an African-American who grew up in Southern California. But Flynn says he and his hero had more than just baseball in common. Robinson's father left when he was a baby. Flynn was growing up without his father, too. Stephen Flynn was a dock worker who got sick on the job. He ended up in the hospital for 5 years.
A lot of longshoremen got hurt or sick. There's all kinds of tuberculosis and problems like that. My mother cleaned office buildings at night. So even when I was 10 years old, I had to go out and hustle and try to make a few dollars and try to help my mother out as best as I could.
Flynn shined shoes. He sold newspapers. Sometimes, after selling papers at the ballparks, Boston had 2 major league teams back then, Flynn would stick around to ask for autographs. The city's National League team, the Boston Braves, played just a mile up the road from Fenway Park.
I recall very vividly standing outside the visitors' locker room at Braves Field, as opposed to the home team locker room where all the young kids from Roxbury, Southie, Charlestown, Brighton, all wanted to get the Braves' autographs. I wanted to get the best player's autograph.
And the very best player, at least in the eyes of 10-year-old Ray Flynn, was Jackie Robinson.
So he comes out of the locker room, and I saw him, and I went up to him, and I says, "Mr. Robinson, I said, could I have your autograph?" And he looks at me, and he says, "Sure." So he signs the autograph book for me, and I said, "Mr. Robinson, could I carry your bag?" He looks at me hesitantly, and he says, "Sure, take the bag." So he gave me the bag. I was barely able to carry it. I was so young. I carried the bag up to the taxi stand on the main street. He gets in the taxi. He puts his hand in his pocket and takes out some money. And he says, "Here, kid, thanks for carrying my bag." And I says, "Oh, Mr. Robinson," I says, "I don't want any money." I said, "It was a real honor, you know, to carry your bag." This kid from South Boston here. He looks at me and then he says, "Well, I'll see you again." I says, "Okay, Mr. Robinson," and off he goes to the hotel. You know, I went home and I told my brother, my older brother, and he says, "You mean to say he offered you money and you didn't take it?" "Wow," he says, "I would have taken the money."
Flynn knew his family could use the cash, but he says letting Jackie Robinson know that he had a fan in Boston was more important.
Well, about 2 weeks later, the Dodgers are back in town again. The Brooklyn Dodgers are back in town again playing the Braves. Here I am in the same location, the same situation. About 30 or 40 kids from Boston are all waiting outside the Braves locker room to get the Braves autograph. And I'm there with Jackie Robinson. He looks at me. He says, "You already got my autograph?" I says, "Yeah, I got your autograph." I said, "Mr. Robinson, can I carry your bag again?" It would seem like he would always come out of the locker room and he'd look around and he'd see me there. We used to talk back and forth, but he just had this instinct of saying the right thing. He knew how I was dressed. I didn't have expensive clothes, just shabby dungarees and an old sweatshirt. He could tell that there wasn't much money there. But he would just give you these words of encouragement.
Flynn learned everything he could about Robinson's life, not just the statistics, which he can still rattle off, but also about Robinson's time before Major League Baseball, graduating from UCLA, serving as an officer in the Army. Flynn even studied Robinson's family.
I mean, I knew the whole story about Jackie Robinson A to Z, and every time I had the chance of walking with him up to the taxi stand, I'd always bring up some kind of little fact or statistic that would really surprise him, you know, like how I knew all of that. I said to him one time, I said, "Your brother ran in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin with Jesse Owens, the great Jesse Owens." I said, "In the stands was Adolf Hitler." And he says to me, "How old are you?" I says, "I'm 10 years old." He said, "How do you know all this?" Then he says, "I hope you're smart in math and English as you are about Jackie Robinson's background in history and sports."
The walk from the visitor's clubhouse to the taxi stand on Commonwealth Avenue didn't take long. It couldn't have been more than a block or two. But between those brief encounters and the things he read about Robinson in the papers he sold, Flynn came to realize just how much adversity Robinson had overcome. And he came to realize that he could overcome his circumstances, too.
Nobody told us to go to college. Nobody told us that we could play major league sports. Nobody told us we could be successful. Nobody ever told us that we could achieve anything. And that's what Jackie Robinson did. He used to inspire young people to do things that they probably didn't think they could do.
Ray Flynn became a very good college basketball player. He even made it briefly onto the Boston Celtics roster, but was cut before the season began. Once it became clear that he wasn't going to make it as an athlete, Flynn decided his life's work would be to help kids who were poor, like he had been. First, he was a coach. Then in 1971, he became a state representative. That's when he met Jackie Robinson again.
Just as I was starting to come up, Jackie was starting to fail.
Jackie Robinson had diabetes. By the end, he was almost blind and had trouble walking. Flynn was friendly with the mayor of New York, so he asked for a favor. Could you call Jackie Robinson and see if he'd be up for a visit from a politician from South Boston? Robinson said yes.
So I hopped on the train. I went down to New York. There was a police officer with me, showed me the way. And I went in and I saw Jackie Robinson, invited me right in, he and his wife. He made us sandwiches and we sat and talked. And he said, "Why are you so interested in wanting to talk to me? You were kind of young when I was at my heyday." So I says, "Mr. Robinson," I says, he says, "Stop. You're going to start calling me Jackie now." I says, "Okay." I said, "I was the little kid that was waiting outside the visitor's locker room at Braves Field."
Unbelievable, Ray Flynn remembers Jackie Robinson saying. "You're my number one fan." Flynn isn't sure Robinson actually remembered him. How could he? He must have met so many kids over the years. They talked over the phone a few times after that, but they never again met in person. Robinson died in 1972. Ray Flynn went on to become a city councilor, then mayor in 1983. In 1993, Flynn left Boston to become the ambassador to the Vatican. That's where he became close with Pope John Paul II and Mother Teresa. Ray Flynn lives a quieter life now. He takes care of his grandson, who's disabled. Together, they explore the city. And whenever he gets the chance, Flynn talks about meeting Jackie Robinson. He says it's a story kids today need to hear.
I worked with popes, presidents, and prime ministers. I knew two saints, personal friends of two saints. But I learned more about life from Jackie Robinson than I learned from any politician that I ever met.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
When Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers, manager Leo Durocher told his players they could get used to the idea or they could leave. So what made Durocher and Robinson enter a decades-long feud? That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank JF for the following iTunes review. Simply one of the best shows to learn about our world through the perspective of sports. Constantly compelling, informative, and compassionate. Thank you, Bill Littlefield. Thank you, JF, and thanks to everyone who's left a review of Only a Game on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. We'll get back to Jackie Robinson stories in just a little bit. But now it's time for three stories you should know. Joining me are Kevin Merida, editor and chief of ESPN's The Undefeated, and Julie DeCaro. She's the host at 670 The Score in Chicago and a sports and culture writer. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Kevin, your story is about records and rebels and the end of the NBA regular season.
Oklahoma City Thunder guard Russell Westbrook on Sunday recorded his 42nd triple-double game of the season, meaning that he scored at least 10 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists.
And in his case, lots more of each most of the time.
Lots more for 42 games, and there are only 82 games in the season. So he broke a 55-year-old record in the NBA that was set by Oscar Robertson. But not only that, he is only the second player to average a triple-double for the season. That is an incredible achievement. I mean, it's one of the storied records. It's the kind of record for basketball. People can argue whether that's like averaging 400 Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak, but it's a really big record in sports. And it's done by a player, and this is the interesting thing, that he's kind of a rebel. You know, he's has a crazy fashion look. He's not always the most media-friendly guy. And the question sitting out there now is, will he be the MVP of the season? And a lot of people say he's got to be. But there's James Harden from the Houston Rockets that's in contention. But my thought about it is, can he be the face of the league? Can he be this star that the league and the public will embrace?
I think he's a terrific candidate to be the face of the NBA. I completely agree that that's up there with Ted Williams and a whole bunch of, you know, baseball guys in terms of what he's accomplished. And I've really been very inspired by Russell Westbrook this year. I know that the kids on my block have been very inspired by him. They're all out there yelling, Westbrook, you know, every time they drive to the hoop.
My sons love him. It's hard not to root for him because he's undersized. He wasn't recruited heavily in college. He brings it every day with a kind of ferocity that is befitting of his team's name, Thunder.
The other thing that strikes me is how fortunate the NBA is in terms of publicity and public relations. There always seems to be a great story for people to focus on in the NBA. If it's not Russell Westbrook, it's LeBron James coming back to Cleveland and bringing a championship to his hometown and all the rest. Steph Curry. The other sports just don't have these magnificent stories surfacing one right after the other that keep people paying attention to it.
Football. Though the Cubs won the World Series?
And then what do you got before that? You got to go all the way back to Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire.
That's right.
Or Cal Ripken,
we know what happened
for goodness
there.
Sake. Right. So, yeah, have we decided that he's going to be the face of the NBA?
I don't know, but I think he should get the MVP. He has my vote, though I don't have a vote.
Me neither.
But he has my vote on my block and in my barbershop.
Fair enough. Julie, take us to Major League Baseball.
Well, the story that I wanted to talk about happened the day before opening day, or a couple days before opening day of this year. Major League Baseball announced that they were going to suspend Juris Familia for 15 games under the league's domestic violence policy. That was quite a departure from what they'd done before. The range before had been 30 to 82 games. And one of the reasons that they gave for departing so much from what had been standard is that Familia undertook 12 90-minute counseling sessions. That was curious because Aroldis Chapman, whose incident, by all accounts, was much more severe than Juris Familia, was only required to do one counseling session. And we don't have information on what other kind of counseling other players have done. They're supposedly evaluated by a panel of domestic violence experts. But it sort of begs the question, who could look at both cases, one that involved a gun and a baby, for Aroldis Chapman and say he only needs to do one counseling session while Juris Familia needs to do, you know, 12 or however many he's been ordered to do. I think it's really important to get the counseling right. So domestic violence experts will tell you there's a specific kind of counseling that abusers need. It's called abuser counseling or abuser intervention counseling. It's usually a six-month program. So I'm just really curious exactly who's evaluating these guys and who's making these decisions at Major League Baseball.
Kevin, it sounds as if Julie is talking about an evolving policy that isn't evolving. Is that how you read this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we don't really know. The public doesn't know what kind of counseling it is. The public doesn't know if that really is, you know, helpful. And we don't really know if the degree to which the bigger concern is the public image, both for the sport and for the player. And you would like to know a little bit more.
So often when athletes are involved in these things, public relations is the first concern. And with the NFL, that certainly has been very obvious for a very long time in terms of the concussion settlements and various other things too. And it's kind of crazy that, as you say, correctly, I think, we hear about these things when celebrities are involved and particularly when athletes are involved because obviously it's a societal cultural problem and we ought to hear about it all the time and it ought to be addressed at every level by every organization concerned. And I'm not sure Major League Baseball and the NFL and the NHL should be involved at all. I think these are potentially criminal acts, not just something to be handled by the commissioner of his sport.
Yeah, and I think that when it comes to looking at the way the leagues are handling domestic violence, I think MLB is by far and away doing the best job. And I think it's great that they gave Juris Familia, that there's an incentive to get help. But I think that when they set up these internal boards to determine how guys are going to be disciplined, they have it in the NFL, they have it in MLB, there's a tension there because MLB wants these guys back on the field.
All right, it's my turn. The Oakland Raiders, reportedly the only NFL team that has not had a player arrested over the past 3 years. Now, for people who know the history of the Oakland Raiders, this is quite stunning. These are obviously the new Oakland Raiders. Back in my day when Al Davis owned the team, he only hired guys with criminal records, at least as far as I can recall. Current face of the Raiders is, of course, quarterback Derek Carr, known for helping a stranger whose car had broken down and various other acts of kindness. Is this enough of a feel-good story to keep people going to games in Oakland because now they know that the team is only going to be there for a couple of more years and then they're going to move to Las Vegas? Do people show up now because they're the nicest guys in the league?
I worry for them. You know, our own Mark Spears, who is an NBA writer but lives in Oakland and grew up and played basketball there, he gave up his season tickets. And it's such a city that is a hard scrabble city. There are a lot of guys who really rep Oakland. And I feel like there's going to be a lot of disappointment, and they may get punished for that.
You know, the NFL's priorities are so far out of whack. I mean, we've got guys getting punished for very minor drug offenses. We've got guys, you know, involved in domestic violence incidents and drunk driving who get off relatively easy. And we've got the NFL now concerned about punishing a whole bunch of players for taking part in an arm wrestling tournament because they think it's too close to gambling. Meanwhile, you've got a team that's going to play for 2 years in front of its fans who know it's leaving. I mean, it's just
and
kind of a
leaving
mess.
For the capital of gambling.
Yes. And I think the fans are the ones that really, you know, wind up taking the brunt of their selective outrage.
You don't think people have just gotten to the point where they're used to this?
A younger generation, I think. My kids cheer for players.
Yeah.
And that's a function of fantasy football, and that's a function of Madden. But, you know, my generation, Generation X and going forward, and those are the fans that have the money, I think those fans are going to take it really hard.
And Oakland's a good team. I mean, they were a team on the rise, and the team is a feel-good story for the area. I mean, that's the extra level of disappointment, that finally we have a team that's a winner again, great young quarterback, and here we go. They're going to be gone.
So no matter that none of them are getting arrested these days, they're leaving.
Oh, that's nice.
And that's the story.
That's quaint.
Yeah.
That's nice.
I think they kind of liked him getting arrested. I mean, that was always the image when I was growing up. The Raiders were like
bad
the bad
boys.
Guys.
Yeah, they get the painted faces and the helmets with the spikes on them and all that. Yeah. Well, excuse me, Julie and Kevin. I have to go check ESPN to see if anybody employed by the Raiders has been arrested while we've been having this conversation. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Kevin Merida of The Undefeated and sports and culture writer Julie DeCaro. Thank you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
In the best of worlds, Jackie Robinson's first major league manager would have been Leo Durocher. Durocher was, in fact, in charge of the Brooklyn Dodgers during the early spring of 1947, before Robinson was to join the team, thereby integrating the major leagues. And during spring training, before Robinson arrived, a rumor reached Durocher that he'd be receiving a petition from the Dodgers who objected to the integration of the team.
He told them what they could do with the petition, which was an act of sanitation, personal hygiene.
Baseball historian Paul Dixon says Durocher made his point in dramatic fashion, which was typical of the manager.
He gets them all out of bed. In the middle of the night, he calls them down to the kitchen in the hotel. And he shows up in his bathroom, and he just starts yelling at them. And he said, you guys have to take this guy. And I don't care if he's green or yellow or pink. I don't care what he is. He's going to win for us. He's going to make us a winning team. And if you guys don't like it, you can do such and such and such and such. And then he got quite profane.
Durocher's efforts on behalf of Robinson and, not coincidentally, on behalf of improving the ball club and earning himself more money were not limited to one blue night in the kitchen of the hotel where the Dodgers were staying. Durocher, who had recently wed movie star Lorraine Day, continued those efforts throughout the remainder of the preseason while the Dodgers were playing exhibition games in the Dominican Republic.
And he would leave the games early and she would leave with him. And the paper's saying, you know, Leo's going back to the hotel for a little extra innings with his new bride and all this stuff. And Leo was going back there to take one player at a time and convince him that he had to drop this racial attitude towards Robinson. He basically sold one player after another on why they had to do this and why they, if they didn't, they were doomed. It wasn't Robinson who was doomed.
So no matter that in 1947, some of the Dodgers weren't ready for integration, Leo Durocher was. In fact, he'd been ready for some time.
As early as 1939, Durocher had told a reporter for the Daily Worker, which was the communist newspaper in New York City, that he really wanted to draft some Negro players, as he put it. He had actually scouted a couple guys in Cuba. He wanted to bring them up, but he was told he couldn't, and he even blamed the commissioner. In 39, started blaming the commissioner for this.
Durocher's freedom from racial prejudice could be traced back a lot further. well before he'd seen a major league ballpark or first kicked dirt on an umpire's shoes, DeRocher was holding down a factory job and fielding ground balls on weekends for a semi-pro team in western Massachusetts, uncertain if he'd ever play anywhere else.
There's a guy named David Redd, who's a black man, who pushes and pushes and pushes DeRocher to go try out for the Hartford team, which in those days was a semi-Yankee farm club. And DeRocher does, tries, fails once.
Having failed, DeRocher must have found it impossible to imagine that he'd soon be teaming up with Babe Ruth to win a pennant with the Yankees. But his friend wouldn't let him give up.
This David Redd pushes him again. And this is an African-American man who DeRocher befriends for the rest of his life. For many, many, many years, he sends David Redd World Series and playoff tickets, brings him down to New York or wherever he's working at the time.
DeRocher, who began managing the Dodgers in 1939, should get credit for helping to prepare the Dodgers for Jackie Robinson's arrival. Unhappily for the manager, he was not on hand for that historic occasion. By associating with gamblers, gangsters, and actor bad guy George Raft, DeRocher had made Commissioner Happy Chandler unhappy enough to suspend the manager for a year. If he had been in the Dodgers' dugout when Robinson first arrived, perhaps the two of them would have gotten along well. The Dodgers won the pennant that season and led the National League in attendance. Times were good. But when DeRocher returned to the club after serving his suspension, he was not pleased with Robinson's appearance.
He'd been on the banquet circuit all winter. He was a popular after-dinner speaker. He'd put on 20 pounds. DeRocher immediately started insulting him, telling the press that, you know, Jackie Robinson's gotten fat just for me, called him fatso. Robinson really learned to hate DeRocher, referred to him along the lines of a cologne-soaked bully. It got worse and worse and worse and worse. So for years, they were at each other's throats.
In retrospect, perhaps the tension between the two men wasn't surprising. Throughout his career, DeRocher had been an instigator, a fighter, a fellow who thumbed his nose at authority and convention. When Robinson came to the Dodgers, he was ordered to refrain from responding to the insults and epithets that came his way. Perhaps, at least at first, he couldn't play the way DeRocher had always played himself and the way he expected everybody to play. And there was more. According to Paul Dixon, Robinson was a homebody. DeRocher felt most at home in nightclubs. As Dixon put it in his recent biography of Leo DeRocher, subtitled Baseball's Prodigal Son, it was almost like two different lifestyles were fighting with one another. The two men didn't have to tolerate each other's lifestyles for long. On July 4, 1948, Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey sent word to DeRocher that he wanted him to resign. DeRocher refused, but 11 days later, Rickey asked the owner of the rival New York Giants how he'd feel about Leo DeRocher moving from Brooklyn to the Polo Grounds to manage the Giants. As the Giants' manager had recently resigned, the path was clear for one of the oddest deals ever concluded between two major league teams.
People were horrified. It was like Lee had run the Civil War or that David had hugged Goliath. The story is broken by the World Telegram. World Telegram ran what they call in the newspaper business, or they used to, Second Coming Headline, which was a 9-inch head that said DeRocher to Giants or Leo to Giants. It was in red ink. There was nothing like it.
A year later, Robinson and the Dodgers would win another pennant, but the feud between Robinson and DeRocher burned ever brighter. Both of them were accomplished at needling opponents, and each targeted the other when the Dodgers and Giants would meet. Monty Irvin, who befriended Robinson and played for DeRocher, told Paul Dixon that Leo used to tell Jackie he was swell-headed, and Jackie would call Leo a traitor for leaving the Dodgers. There was evidence that the relationship could change at the All-Star Game at Philadelphia's Shibe Park in 1952. DeRocher was managing the National League stars, and on a wet, muddy field, Robinson made a couple of errors. He was booed for it. But when Robinson apologized, DeRocher shook his head and said, "Jackie, you were great." That was the story he stuck with after the game.
And he went to one of the newspapers and said, you know, how can they boo this guy? What he's done for this game is impossible to understand, and he's really a great player and a great hero. And so he starts reversing. and Robinson does too.
DeRocher's admiration for what Robinson had done was genuine, and over time he was more comfortable expressing it. As Paul Dixon has written, sometime late in DeRocher's time with the Giants, the two men met in Philadelphia. He rushed up to me and hugged me and was genuinely friendly, said Robinson. I was so moved by the gesture that I wrote him a letter telling him what it meant to me. Jackie Robinson died in 1972. He was only 53. Leo DeRocher died in 1991. By then, he'd been passed over by the electors of the Hall of Fame enough times so that he'd announced he was no longer interested. Perhaps that was all the electors needed to hear. In 1994, he was voted in. At the induction ceremony, DeRocher's former wife, Lorraine Day, mentioned the men who were Leo's favorite players because they had, quote, shared his kind of fire. At the top of her list was Jackie Robinson. Toward the end of his MLB career in the early 2000s, Luke Collier started noticing the number of African-American players was dropping.
I would talk to guys and I'd be like, how many brothers in the organization with y'all? They'd be like, five. I was like, five? I couldn't understand that.
That's coming up on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Hi, it's Bill Littlefield. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Only a Game, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, and it'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us, so thank you. I'm Bill Littlefield. Arlene Piper was the first woman to officially run a marathon, but she didn't find that out until 50 years later. That's next week on Only a Game. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
According to the final regular season standings, the Cleveland Cavaliers are the second best team in the East. Who'd have guessed that would be the case?
You know, the number one seed is the Boston Celtics, who may or may not on the merits deserve to be, but they won the most games. I still think Cleveland is the team to beat in the East, and I think Cleveland's the team to beat for the championship.
Here's an odd late-season stat. Portland Trail Blazers forward Mo Harkless did not take a single shot from behind the three-point line during the last four games of the season, and as a result, he got a $500,000 bonus. Explain, please.
Explain? Mo Harkless is the smartest man in the world. That's the explanation. He had a clause in his contract that if he shot 35% or better, he would make $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes into the last four games.
Keeping track.
Yes, shooting 35.1%. And you can't miss any shot, Bill, that you don't take.
That's right.
Way to go, Mo.
He's the anti-Ted Williams.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Ted is informed that he's hitting 399.51.
And it'll round up.
And if he just sits down, it'll round up to 400, and he says, nah. And he goes out and goes 4-for-7.
Yes. But not Mo Harkless. Math is wonderful.
One guy representing a group that monitors college sports suggested this week that the long-running academic scandal at UNC is, quote, 10 times worse than the Louisville stripper scandal in which recruits were entertained by exotic dancers. You good with that math?
Yes, absolutely, because the North Carolina scandal is dry rot through the entire institution of the university.
Yes, and it also involved a lot more than just one night of partying.
Yes, exactly. I mean, exactly right. I mean, even if you assume that there were nights of partying we don't know about at Louisville, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. I think is a pretty safe assumption, the UNC scandal is still worse.
On Monday, the soccer federations of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada announced a joint bid for the 2026 World Cup. And President Trump was apparently okay with that. I wonder if that was because at the news conference, the U.S. Federation got to speak first.
Yeah, probably. I think this is going to be the World Cup United States with, you know, and friends, as they say, in like farewell rock concerts. How would you like to play 1 week in Vancouver and the other one in Mexico City?
I'm okay with it.
I understand you are, Bill. We could play soccer on the moon and you would be okay with
it. I'd watch. New York Giants quarterback Eli Manning is being accused of fraud. Instead of providing actual game-used equipment as part of a contract he had signed with a sports memorabilia company, Eli apparently sent an email to the Giants equipment manager asking for, quote, two helmets that can pass as game-used. Here's my question. Is a helmet at the center of a fraud scandal worth more than one that's game-used?
Well, it depends how widespread the scandal is. I mean, would a baseball signed by the 1919 Black Sox be worth more than a baseball signed by the 1919 world champion Cincinnati Reds? You bet it would.
You bet it would, right.
As far as this goes, I mean, there's a strong impulse in me that says caveat emptor and that anybody who gets into memorabilia collecting deserves what they get. But this sounds really, really bad for Eli.
Yeah, it's not good. The Atlanta Falcons appeared to be heading for a win in the most recent Super Bowl, you will recall, but they lost, and we learned this week how Falcons quarterback Matt Ryan went about getting over that loss. Would you characterize watching that game over and over and over as therapy or masochism?
I hope Matt Ryan's relatives staged an intervention at one point and said, Matt, you really ought to eat.
Pulled the plug.
You really ought to eat or get a little air or something. You know what? You're not going to hang on to the ball when Dante Hightower hits you, no matter how long you watch the film. So I'll tell you what. Why don't we move along?
I guess people go see Hamlet again and again, even though they know how it's going to come out, right?
Yeah, but Hamlet doesn't go to see Hamlet over and over again to see how it works out.
The members of the Chicago Cubs have received their World Series championship rings, and you will not be surprised to see that they're exceptionally gaudy. However, somebody with a sense of humor had a hand in the design of that ring. You like the goat?
Yeah, they put a little goat on the top of it.
Yeah.
For
curse
of the
goat.
The old Billy Goat curse. Yeah. Yeah, they are pretty gaudy. I mean, 214 diamonds, that's a lot for one hand.
Pretty soon, we're going to get to the point where it requires two hands to lift one of these.
Oh, have you ever, like, actually held
one?
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
You can't lift your hand.
We've had people in this studio with those rings on their fingers, and I have to constantly tell them to stop banging them hammer-like on the table because they ruin the entire
broadcast. I noticed a crack in the table over there.
And finally, Charlie.
This one I'll laugh at.
It's not funny.
It's hilarious. It's hockey.
Okay.
It's playoff hockey.
I'm going to try and read it straight. We have to tip our hats to a Pittsburgh Penguin fan who shall remain nameless because I don't know his name. Anyway, he was watching the Pens game the other night in an auto body shop that he owns, and he got into an argument, and the guy arguing with him stabbed him in the head with a screwdriver. And when the paramedics arrived to take this guy to the hospital, he told them, forget it, I'll drive myself to the hospital. I want to watch till the end of the game. This doesn't happen in other sports, right?
Stabbed in the head! Stabbed in the head, Bill. But he is not going anywhere till he sees the Pens boot at home.
And they won.
If the Penguins don't give this guy a seat, a season ticket for free for the next 10 years, I'm very disappointed in them. This is, as you said, this is hockey and nowhere else.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time. And he joins me each week here at Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
When Jackie Robinson retired in 1957, the number of African-American players in Major League Baseball was increasing. By the 1970s, African-Americans made up close to 20% of all MLB players. That number stayed in the high teens through the early 90s, and then it dropped. By 2013, Major League Baseball was just 8.5% African-American. This is a story about one former major leaguer who watched that decline and who's now trying to reverse the trend. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Lou Collier grew up on the south side of Chicago during the 70s and 80s. He remembers wanting a better life. Collier's mom was a social worker. His father was a Vietnam vet who worked for Sherwin-Williams. They lived in the Roseland neighborhood.
You know, it was low-income housing. It was like a close-knit community. Nobody came in, nobody came out.
Collier spent weekends watching Cubs games with his dad on TV. He looked up to African-American players. Sometimes his dad told him stories about Jackie Robinson.
He just told me that it always looked like he was playing like it was his last day, you know, that he might not ever get another chance to do it. So he left everything out on the field. And I just remember that, and that's how I played.
Back then, Collier says baseball was all over the south side of Chicago.
Baseball was king in my neighborhood.
Collier's side of the neighborhood fielded a team. They called themselves the White Sox. They'd play the kids from the other side, the Royals.
It was like the World Series. We played each other in seven-game series, you know. The neighborhood was only so big, but one team would have their home field in one area of the neighborhood, and the other team had their home field in another area of the neighborhood. And the fields was makeshift field. It wasn't, I'm telling you, it wasn't 90 feet. It was just like, hey, okay, we're going to put the bases here.
Collier says the fields were too narrow because they were wedged between houses.
I remember guys hitting balls through apartment windows. But those games was intense. As a kid, it was everything to me. It wasn't no pickup game. It was like, man, you better come with it.
By the time he was 8, Collier was playing with 13-year-olds. He kept getting better, and he started seeing baseball as a way out. Collier went on to play at a nearby junior college. Then the Pittsburgh Pirates picked him in the 31st round of the 1992 MLB draft. Back then, Collier says there were 70 to 100 other African-American players in the Pirates organization. It wasn't always easy for them.
The opposing fans would say anything to try to distract you, whether they meant it or not. I've heard the N-word. I heard that my mom stinks, that I'm a bum. And then I realized, like, man, it must have been 10 times tougher for Jackie Robinson.
Collier says it all made him play harder. In 97, he got called up to Pittsburgh. 2 years later, he got picked up by the Milwaukee Brewers. They had a veteran African-American player, a guy named Marquise Grissom.
Once I made the team, he was like, man, don't worry about finding nowhere to live. You're going to live with me. It's like, man, are you serious? And he said, I got you. Don't worry about it. And that was a blessing. That was a blessing. You know, it just taught me how to be a professional. That right there changed my life.
Grissom also taught Collier something about being a mentor, but we'll get to that later. Collier spent 8 years in the big leagues, played for 5 different teams. And by the early 2000s, he started noticing something.
In the whole organization, it'd be 3 or 4 African-Americans. And I'm like, what is this? Can't be true. I would talk to guys and I'd be like, how many brothers in the organization with y'all? They'd be like, 5. I was like, 5? Like, what kind of, I couldn't understand that. You felt like something wasn't right because you know that the talent is there. So what's the difference now?
There have been a lot of theories. Some say youth baseball has gotten too expensive. Some say scouts look for talent at fancy travel team tournaments, not in inner cities.
I can't pinpoint what the exact reasons were, but I told myself, you know what, I'm going to go back home and I'm going to teach the game to kids in my community. I'll do my part.
So after retiring, Collier went back to Chicago, started going to Little League games. A lot had changed. Kids' fundamentals were worse, like they weren't playing as often. Collier's friends told him that ever since Michael Jordan came to town, basketball was king. And then there was the violence.
Chicago is a rough, rough city. It's tough. The education system is failing. The gangs are bad. The murder rate is up. It's a lot of obstacles that kids have to endure on a daily basis, just living.
Collier decided to start a travel team. They would go to those expensive weekend tournaments where scouts would see them. He started recruiting players from community centers and little league games. He found sponsors to offset fees. That first year, he fielded 2 teams. Since then, the Lou Collier Baseball Association has grown and even lured in some basketball players. Take Josh Williams. A couple years ago, when he was 12, Williams showed up at a basketball gym and found Collier practicing baseball with his players. Williams poked his head in and asked,
can I join a team? And then I looked at him like, man. I said, where have you played? He said, I never played before. I'm like, wow. But I looked at him, and he looked like he was serious, and he had a pretty athletic body. So we added him to the team. I told our head coach, I said, we got a new player, a basketball player. And he just laughed. Like, man, what I'm going to do with a basketball player that never played?
At the start of the season, Williams struck out every at-bat. At the end of the year, the team went to a tournament, reached the championship. Williams hadn't played much, but the night before the game, he said,
"Coach, I'm ready. I need to be in there." And I seen in his eyes, I'm like, man, okay. So the next day I told the head coach, I was like, man, get him in the lineup. I said, just put him in there. And he looked at me like I was crazy. I was like, for real, I'm serious. Bat him ninth. And he was like, all right, man. He put him in the lineup, man. This kid went 3 for 4, 2 home runs, and drove in like 7 runs. We were so excited for him. And he was like, I told you, coach.
Now, Josh Williams is a high school sophomore. Collier says he has a good shot at landing a college scholarship. So far, dozens of kids from the Lou Collier Baseball Association have gone on to play college ball.
That's what was on my heart when I came back, to try to change lives like that.
The program now serves about 130 kids. Sometimes Collier tells them stories about Jackie Robinson. He says that they should never let negativity distract them from their dreams. And Lou Collier is optimistic that more African Americans will reach the big leagues. Just last year, Corey Ray from the South Side of Chicago was the 5th overall pick in the MLB draft.
Baseball is back happening in Chicago. Yeah, it's back happening.
Lou Collier, who grew up watching black players on television, hopes that someday soon, kids on the South Side of Chicago will turn on their TVs and see Corey Ray. And they'll believe, just as Collier did, that they can make better lives for themselves. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
It's a fine thing to celebrate Jackie Robinson's achievements, which were prodigious. I think he'd be disappointed. No, I'm sure he'd be disappointed, if not outraged, if we didn't also note the extent to which baseball and the world outside its lines have failed to respond to Jackie Robinson's powerful call for equal opportunity and equal rights. As Rachel Robinson said on the occasion of a recent documentary about her husband, there is a lot more that needs to be done. It's an understatement. Major League Baseball has 30 teams. 2 of them have black managers. 2 of them have black general managers. As we just heard, black major leaguers aren't as common as they used to be. There are lots of reasons for that, and some of them don't reflect badly on anybody. Lots of great black athletes aim for the NBA or the NFL instead. But quick, name a baseball player as omnipresent as LeBron James is and Michael Jordan was. This is partly Major League Baseball's fault. They're not much good at marketing their product to people who don't already like it. Or maybe they don't care to do it, in which case it's more than partly their fault. But the greater outrage becomes apparent as we acknowledge, again, 70 years after Jackie Robinson joined the Dodgers, that his significance transcends the game he played from 1947 until 1956. Robinson provided hope and inspiration to people who had no intention of playing baseball or working in sports. His message was that courage and righteous determination can overcome prejudice, hypocrisy, and hatred. And sadly, the message today, in a nation where black citizens are incarcerated at 6 times the rate of their white counterparts, and where the poverty rate for blacks is almost twice as high as it is for whites, is that the battle must continue. It's a fine thing that Major League Baseball retired Jackie Robinson's number in 1997, and it's a lovely gesture for each Major League player to wear his 42 on Jackie Robinson Day. But wouldn't Jackie Robinson be among the first to affirm that symbols and gestures are nothing compared to the eventual realization of genuine equal rights and equal opportunity and the full realization of justice in all of its manifestations for everybody? Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word this week comes from former mayor of Boston and former ambassador to the Vatican, Ray Flynn.
I've seen the movie 42. I've seen it 7 times. I could play the role of Jackie Robinson in the movie.
Oh, that's great. Now I don't feel so silly about having always wanted to play Willie Mays. Not in the movies, in center field. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.